This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations. Hello, everybody. This is Yesid Ortega, and this is Chasing Encounters. We have one more special guest today. Today, we're going to be talking about some of the things that we are both concerned in terms of research and in terms of other interesting things, but you will hear about it. So I would like to welcome today Noreen Tash, right?
Yes. Thank you, Yesid. Thank you for having me here today.
No problem. Thank you for accepting this invitation. And this is the first time we are actually using technology. Before, you know, in the past, I used to record this at the studios at the University of Toronto. But because of COVID, obviously, we cannot do this in person. So we're using Teams, and we are recording this on Teams from Microsoft. So let's see how it goes.
Okay, so, let's do it.
And I always start with the name. So your name is Noreen and your last name is Tash, if yes. I pronounce it well. Do you have an idea of what Noreen means and what Tash means? Where is this coming from?
Yeah, so Noreen Tash, my name is a South Asian name, which is, well, my mother, she has her heritage from Iran and Afghanistan and all that. My father also has a similar heritage. But then this was long time back. So there was a lot of movement and a lot of migration and settling in. So somewhere in time, my great-grandfather, fathers from both sides might have settled in Pakistan. So this is how my name is. This because my mom liked this name. And just to add in that the migration at that time was mostly because South Asian, there is a long history of South Asia of movement and people coming from Central Asia and Arabs and Turks from different parts and to this land, which was predominantly a Hindu religious land. So, and then Muslims started coming in, and then all that happened until the time when Mughals actually started a big empire and ruled that region. And eventually then British came in and colonized that for about 200 years. And then in about 1947, we had this separation of India and Pakistan. Yeah. So my parents might have just migrated from one part of the other, yeah.
So you have a history of immigration or migration, movement, bodies here and there, I guess.
Yes, that's a lot. So, and then a part of me, because I'm a South Asian Muslim, so a part of me is as much South Asian as Muslim is. So when I say South Asian, it means I'm talking about that culture, that region, and which was a land where South Asian culture was followed for centuries. And when I say Muslim, that means those values came in from Arabs somewhere in around 700th century. And then people started converting to Islam. So when I say I'm a South Asian Muslim, it means I am carrying two different things together, a culture which is South Asian and a religion which is Muslim.
I am so glad that you're talking about this because I when I speak to people from all around the world in this podcast, we cannot detach ourselves, our identities and who we are, our names, our histories from our culture, from our values, from our spiritualities or religious beliefs, etc. And I'm glad that you pointed that out, that these things are together, right? Like you mentioned the idea of the land.
Yes.
And then back in the day, the land where your parents were from or are from is called South Asia, right?
Yes.
And for some reason that you, I think you mentioned it, is this idea that it was divided in these countries like India and Pakistan, etc., right? But then you're carrying this with you to this date, and also carrying with you this idea of the religion and the religious values with you, which are intricately connected.
Yes.
Right?
Which are very complex, yes.
Yeah, I imagine, and I know this is not easy to say or to comprehend for a lot of people, especially for me, you know, where I'm coming from. My listeners know already that my background is from Colombia in South America, so pretty much we are people who were born being Catholic. So that's one thing. You're Colombian Catholic, you're Mexican, you're Catholic, etc. That's for a long time it was like that. But I believe from the place where you were born and then your relations is more complicated than that, right? It's more nuanced than that. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about those values and that culture, because I know just this little about the Islamic culture and being Muslim. So what does this mean to you, being Muslim and the values in your culture? And give us some highlights.
Yes. So now the question comes in, which is contested, because am I more South Asian or more Muslim? Because that has been in Pakistan, that has always been there, where people, still today, people are looking for their identity, because when they say Muslim, they automatically assume that they are Arabs. Mm. So when I say Muslim, that means, do I have to follow what Arab culture is? Or do I have to follow what South Asian culture is? So that is where these are the issues which actually are troubling for new generation and people who are growing up, because this is they cannot sense their true identity, or there is no way to explain this, that where do you stand? So when I was growing up, my schooling is in Saudi Arabia. So at that time when I was in Saudi Arabia, in a Muslim South Asian household and attending a Pakistani school and going back to Pakistan during summer vacation and coming back to Saudi for the entire year, it has always been confusing, because when I went to Pakistan, I wasn't Pakistani enough for them. Mm. And when I was in Saudi Arabia, I wasn't Saudi. So, and Saudi enough or not Saudi at all. So these things have always made me confused, and I always wanted to figure out more. And in my PhD study, I've actually looking at girls' education in Pakistan, and a lot of strings actually again go back and get attached to this idea of being Muslim or being South Asian. So when people in Pakistan want to educate their daughters, do they want to raise them as more South Asian, or do they want to raise them as more Muslim? So there are these issues which we need to talk about. Yeah,
right. No, and I'm glad that you're helping us understand a little bit more about what's happening in that part of the world, especially in your own life. And I'm glad to understand a little bit more of that as well. Well, that being said, I would like to ask you about coming to Canada. Mm-hmm. How was this process? Why did you come to Canada with your family? What were the reasons you were thinking of coming? There were any compelling reasons that you said, I want to leave Pakistan and pursue a life in Canada? How was that mm-hmm. process?
So I think coming to Canada has just added another layer to my identity, which is like being an immigrant. Because earlier, it was just between a a daughter is South Asian or Muslim, and then a mother who was somewhere in between South Asian or Muslim. And then coming to Canada was one of the reasons. One of the reasons was that, of course, we wanted to move to a country where our kids could grow up and have better education. So that was, I think, the prime reason to come to Canada. Coming to UFD was a really big decision for me. It was something that came as a surprise. It was something that I had always wanted to do, but I caught up in all the expectations that a South Asian daughter needs to do. You need to get married, you need to have family, all that. So I was just doing all those. I was performing what I was expected to. Even though it wasn't that it was bad, I was happy, but in performing all that. But then coming to Canada means that UFD means I got a chance to go back to what I really wanted to do. So that was interesting. And coming to Canada means that I started to realize what being an immigrant means. So that is something that I learned after coming here, that, okay, this is what an immigrant looks like. This is how an immigrant feels like. This is how the support system for an immigrant must be. So, yeah, the challenges and the support systems and all that.
Right. And something that got me thinking was something that you just mentioned about this is something that I really wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then does that mean that when you were back home, you were doing something, like, were you also engaged in research and education? Were you a teacher? And when you arrived to Canada, then you wanted to continue being a teacher? Can you help us a little bit more about that to understand that?
Yeah, so I was, I've always been a teacher. I was a teacher. When I was young, I used to teach my own younger brother, and then when I started my career, I started as a teacher. When we migrated here, I left my job because I was, so interestingly, I was a teacher in an elite private school in Pakistan.
Right.
And at the same time, I also did my B.Ed., which means that's a government, so that's a degree program where you have to go in public schools and take lessons for about a month and a half and teach students over there. So that is something that I also did before coming here, and I realized there was a big, big difference. They're two different worlds with where I was doing my B.Ed. training lessons and where I was actually working as an elite private school teacher. So that kept, like, those were the confusions that were there. And after coming to Canada, I wanted to go back to school and see what it is for going ahead and pursuing a PhD program. That's something maybe I wanted to do somewhere when I was a child in Saudi Arabia. Maybe somewhere at that time I wanted to go and do a PhD and see how scholars are. That was just, yeah.
Interesting.
What they do, yeah.
I have to ask you a question related to what you just mentioned about being a teacher in an elite private school.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to do with, maybe help us to understand just a little bit briefly, because I'm assuming this is complicated, to understand the difference between the public education and elite private education in Pakistan. What is this difference that it is between one and the other?
As a teacher, when I went to public schools for my training lessons and I went to elite private schools, there are just two different worlds. There, you from entering into the school, from the You like the building, the services, the ground, playground, the cafeteria, the furniture. They're just very, very different. That's one thing. Then the quality, even though when they say public schools and teachers are qualified, the work environment is, that is very, very different. When I was a teacher in elite private school, there was a lot of accountability. Even though there was a lot of training, but then there was a lot of accountability as well. Then you have a very different set of parents that you are dealing with. Those, when you know that there is a parent who has come in the office to talk to you, you know exactly that what kind of, where that direction of discussion would be. And I think one of the reasons that I've only understood after doing my research and my recent work in PhD is that that parents have actually have that cultural capital that they bring in to the school when they start talking and all that. So it is just very, very different.
Yeah, no, this is very interesting what you have said, because as you were talking, it reminded me of some of the work that has happened in Colombia as well. And mm-hmm. got thinking the idea of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And because also I work in Colombia for elite places as well,
private
places, and there is this dichotomy in between the public and the private, right?
Yeah.
So in the private, there is this accountability, and the reason why there is quote-unquote higher accountability is because the parents are behind everything. For the parents are, in the parents' mindset is, I am paying this amount of money and I require high quality education for my children. Whereas in the public sector, there is not this, I mean, there is accountability, but there is not, it's not as high as in the public, in the private sector. Because for the parents, the school is just a blessing for the children. Right? Sort of like it is the school is a way so the children get education, and at least they are not in the streets doing things such as drug addiction and gangs, well, you name it. Right? So I can see definitely the parallels from your country, Pakistan, and the country that I've been working with for so long in Colombia. The idea that parents are the ones who have the capital, the cultural capital and economic capital to drive how the school would look, whereas in the public sector doesn't work necessarily like that.
Yeah.
And that's something that I find very problematic.
Yes, and I would just add one point here that in public, when I was... last year when I went for the data collection and I was speaking to some of the NGOs who run schools for girls' education, what was shocking, nearly shocking for me, was that the students in public school are referred as numbers. So what I was feeling all the time was that when you are running a public school, you are actually looking for registrations that we have. There are dropout students who are not attending the school. This is the dropout rate. So I think with international organizations, interventions, the language there has changed, and the language now is more concerned. The officials are more concerned about the dropout rate. So never have I heard the mentioning of students as students. Like the way I told you that in my BEd, I went to my training lessons and I saw there were amazing students who I could have done or have provided opportunities I could have done better because I saw them as learners. I saw them as students who deserve better opportunities. But then when I was speaking in to the officials in my field work, the references were dropout rate. So I just could not put this together, that if you just look, if you keep on looking students in public schools as a number, and then you have to pull them to school to make your registration numbers as 100% or 98 or 99, then your focus is more on numbers, because that's where the budget is. But then your focus is not on what are the actual problems. Why are they not coming? Who are those students? What are their strengths? So, yeah, there is a lot of work, I think, needed.
Oh, yeah. I imagine. And I'm glad that you started talking about your own research, because that was my exact question. How, like, my next question is, we were talking about your background in Pakistan. So how did you translate all of that knowledge that you had into your PhD thesis? So in other words, tell us briefly about your research. Yeah. Where did this idea came from? Because I understand you work with girls, right?
Yeah.
You also talk about gender as well. Yes. So tell us a little briefly, 3-minute elevator pitch about what your research is about.
Right. So what I'm looking at is, I'm just looking at how global, there is a global talk and debate about girls' education, which is mostly coming from the West, and how is that understood by the local actors in Pakistan. So when I say local actors, I spoke to parents in urban cities, and then I did speak to officials who are doing policy work in Department of Education, which mostly is understood as Ministries of Education here, and different NGOs which are working for improving girls' education. So what I was interested to look at was that when the ideas and concepts and programs and models are discussed globally, what does that mean, and how are they taken up and translated in the local language and local concepts? Because not every concept is a new concept there, and how do they understand that and actually appropriate that, or how do they get refracted in the local landscape? So that's what I am looking at.
Did you find anything interesting now that you're in your sort of last stage of your PhD, writing up, etc.? Yeah. Something that you want to share that you found, like, oh my God, look at this.
Yeah. So interesting is that how I put it there is that when we talk about global ideas around girls' education, they have that implicit meaning of individualism, which is at contrast with the local culture in Pakistan, because that is very much a collective society. So people let some ideas enter, but then do not want their values to be changed somehow. So they find ways to resist that. So when I was there, and the global terminology, empowerment, girls' empowerment, and that's a very common word here, and people talk about it. But then somehow this information is there in the landscape, in local landscape, and they have heard the word empowerment a lot many times. They have word women empowerment. They know what Western feminism is. So these ideas are already there. So when I went there and when I started talking to them, I made sure that I did not use the term empowerment during my interviews, even though I wanted to know how do they empower their daughters. but I avoided this word because initially in my first or second interview, and I did a few interviews here as well before going, so I realized that this is the term which is not setting very well with them. But then it doesn't mean that people over there or women over there or girls over there are not empowered.
So I realize that you don't want to use the term empower, and I understand that this rhetoric is coming into these countries that not necessarily exists there. I mean, the sentiment exists, the culture of empowerment yeah. exists, but the terminology does not necessarily exist. So if you say that you didn't want to use the word empowerment, what are other words that could describe how women or girls feel over there? How would you describe if you were not using the word empowerment? Is there a local word in your language that you could use, perhaps?
Well, how I questioned them were related to their decision making, how confident they felt when they were doing decisions inside their homes, outside their homes. So I brought in different concepts like the idea of public space, the idea of private space, how confident they feel when they are making decisions in the private space, how confident they are when they're making certain decisions for public space, something like that. So I tried to bring in different concepts together to understand this idea of empowerment.
Right.
In their local context.
Also, that I understand that you work with girls, and then how does it feel, or how did you feel as a woman going back to Pakistan and working with girls?
So I actually went there and I met families. So I spoke to parents. They invited me sometimes for dinner, sometimes at tea, mostly in their own homes, where I got to meet their children as well. And those parents were very welcoming. They invited me. They asked me to meet their sons and daughters. And there was the sense of privilege when they introduced me to their kids, that she's a scholar, researcher, she's coming from Canada. See, if you study, you would also be able to do something, PhD. And they also wanted me to share some advice with their children. Mostly the children were in grade 12 or at the beginning years of their undergrad. So they were presenting me as a role model, like if you do this, look at her. But then one thing that I was very, very conscious about was to follow the customs and how the local culture and custom is. So if in that culture, if I would have been wearing like Western clothing, that would have not given me that position of privilege. So what I was conscious as a researcher, that I was wearing what those women were wearing. Like my clothing was similar to how that household clothing was. So there was a sense of belonging and trust they could develop that, okay, I am not a person coming from the West to give them a lecture on how you should raise your kids. And I think this is one of the things that, not during the interviews, but off the recording, people shared with me, that they just do not like people coming from the West and lecturing them about how you should raise your children and raise your kids and all that. And this includes not only teachers and researchers, but mostly their own family, friends, uncles, aunts as well. Those who have lived in the U.S. for about like 15 years, they go back and they tell them, this is how you should do this. So they just don't like that idea of constantly being told that what you are doing is wrong and this is the right way of doing that.
Very interesting for what you're saying. I have two questions, two follow-up questions. One is a very funny and curious question, and the other one more formal or serious. The funny one is, you mentioned that you couldn't have access to this community and be and get the trust and feel this sense of belonging because of your clothing and the way you're dressing, and then you had to sort of adapt yourself to their community, and I'm assuming wearing like your cultural clothing
and my language, add that, and my language as well.
So my question is, like, do you? I don't think I could be able to do this job over there if I go, like, you know, you know me, and then with my Western clothes, I would they would not accept me. Do you think?
No, they will accept you. They will put you at a pedestal. They will be doing everything to do with hospitality. Right. They will just share the good part of that culture with you because they would consider you as a guest.
Oh, that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I thought they were going to reject me because I wear Western clothes, you know, jeans and shirts and...
No. If you go online, you will find a lot of vloggers and YouTube people who go around to different places and share their videos. You will find a lot of vloggers in Pakistan, and most of them are from different parts of the country. And then they get get similar kind of respect on hospitality. But then I had a different intention.
Right.
So, yeah.
No, the reason why I'm asking you this is because one of the purposes and the goals of this podcast is to dismantle the stereotypes that our people get from these places, right? Like Pakistan and then some others in South Asia, etc. Like, even for myself, like, I would assume that people would reject me because of how I'm dressing, you know, maybe how I'm speaking or how I'm behaving. But it certainly is not like that, and I guess I have to go in person to find out.
I think, I'll just add in here, I think there has been a lot of, I don't know history very well, but I don't know what has happened in recent past or somewhere farther, but then somehow I feel Pakistani people, once they take you in, they are very friendly and they will keep you happy, but I'm not sure with they're a little bit reluctant to open up in front of strangers.
Yeah,
they be very hospitable, they will respect you, feed you, do everything, but then they will just not open up.
Right.
So I think that's I don't know what is the reason behind that, how, what has history taught them, I don't know about that, why has that got into their DNA where they have,
No, but it makes sense. It makes sense because, well, how are you going to open yourself with your most intimate things to a person you don't know? Whereas in your case, you are from the community. You speak the language of the community. You have the culture embedded with you and your family. So it would make sense for them to open up in a research project.
Mm-hmm. And I need to, at times, I could not get open answers on recording where the person only spoke after the recording was off.
Right.
And then once the person asked me if the recording was off and I said, yes, it is, then they started talking about the actual issues they were facing and all those fears and all that, which wasn't on the recording.
And of course, you could not use these for that, right? Just for that experience.
That was just for my own learning. And that is the reason I keep saying that I don't know what has happened in the past. I don't know how many times they have opened their doors. I don't know what happened. Why have they lost that trust?
It is generational trauma, I guess. Something has to do with the history of whatever happened, colonization that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And, you know, things like that, maybe. Maybe we need a historian to update on this part. But one second part that I wanted to mention as you were speaking is the idea of you as a researcher, you as a role model, you as a person who would give advice to these people or to these girls or to these peoples. And it reminded me of myself as well, because I relate to that. When I went to Colombia, the students I work with, the teacher would say, see, if you study really hard, if you study English, then you could be like this guy. You can go get out of this country.
Yeah.
And somebody. And I have to stop the teacher and I say, no, that's not the message.
Yes.
For you to be like me, I am glad to hear this, but the message that I want to send is, how can we learn from our own culture, learn to appreciate our own culture first,
yes,
before appreciating the foreign culture.
Yeah.
Right? And be critical of what's happening in the country, so why they do not have the opportunities that others have to explore other contexts, other countries, etc.
Yes.
So I understand exactly what you're talking about, this idea of me being the role model.
Yes. Thank you.
So we have a few minutes before we ended up today.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to ask whether there is anything you want to send a message to our listeners related to your research, related to your culture, your background, anything that you want folks to learn or to understand from you today.
I don't have any advice as such. It's just that my experience as a researcher, I have learned a lot. I think it would have been a different research if I had done it in a desk work. Going out, meeting with people made a big difference. So I think it's all good. One has to come out of the comfort zone. One has to come out of this office space, go out in the field, meet people, do research, find that culture is interesting, and constantly reflect. And that has actually helped me in correcting my own assumptions as well.
Nice. All right. Thank you very much for coming today to our podcast today, Noreen. I really appreciate helping us to understand a little bit more and making the work a little bit closer.
Thank you so much, Yusif. Pleasure to be here. Yeah.
No problem. And as you say, I suggest people to come out of the comfort zone, go out and meet people, and reflect on the work that you have done and that you're doing.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way, or one of the many ways to do research. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Yesid Ortega, and this is Chasing Encounters. Have a good rest of the week, everybody.